Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Justin Brierley, bringing you your weekly dose of thinking faith with Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio and via podcast. Today's show is a special edition. We've no debate for you this week. Instead, it's a highlight show from our Unbelievable conference that took place in London just over a month ago. And what a great joy it was to share the day with hundreds of show listeners. But before we get to some of those highlights, if you're listening in North America via podcast, a reminder that we aren't leaving you out of the picture when it comes to the Unbelievable Conference. Our Unbelievable Live in LA event is coming the 11th and 12th of October to California. In fact, I've actually been in California just recently with my family on a summer break. Was delighted to speak at a couple of churches and meet some listeners. I'll talk a bit more about that later on in the show, let you know what I was up to out there. While I was out there, though, my newsfeed, I'm sure like many people listening, was filled with stories about these high-profile Christians, Josh Harris and Marty Sampson, renouncing their faith, apparently. A lot of hot takes on those stories on my timeline too, but hoping ultimately to get one or maybe both of them on at some point to talk about it. I always feel like sitting down with people to hear their story is always better than second guessing their motives. But we will be responding to the general issues of deconstruction and doubt that their stories represent. In the next couple of shows, we've got some exciting guests joining me. So find out more about that as well later on in the programme. But while I was out there in California, I was able to tell people about Unbelievable Live in LA. It's 2 days to experience the show and the conference at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. On Friday the 11th in the evening, it's a live audience edition of The Big Conversation with Professor John Lennox and Dave Rubin in conversation with me. It's going to be unmissable. And then on the following day, Saturday the 12th of October, Unbelievable, the Conference LA. Speakers including, again, John Lennox, but also Ruth Jackson, J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, and loads of other great thinkers, as we ask, what does it take to change someone's mind about faith? So do book your place for that if you can get along to Unbelievable Live in LA. The website is unbelievable.live. Again, for tickets and more info, unbelievable.live. You're unbelievable. So this year's theme for our London conference was Speaking Truth in a Post-Truth World. And today on the show, you're going to hear some select highlights of what happened. We'll be hearing from Christy Mayer, Bruxy Cavey, Sarah Lumgair, Paul Spears, and some of the panel discussion that rounded off the day. Now, if you want to get hold of the whole day on DVD and MP3 CD, that's over 13 hours of material, you can actually pre-order it now. Go to the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and click on the DVD link at the top of the page. And it's also available, as usual, as a digital download too. Order it now, it'll get to you in September when we dispatch it. Now, if you do get that DVD or download, you'll get the sight of me actually coming on stage at the opening of the conference as my alter ego, Don Schmurgundy. And as anyone who's seen the promo we put out ahead of the conference will know, you'll know who Don Schmurgundy is from that. But we're not going to feature that just now on this highlights show. We're going to dive straight into me opening up the conference with a prayer and introducing the first speaker, Krish Kandaya, on Conversations Matter. It's not just what you say, it's how you say it.
Now, I'm aware we always get a mixed audience here at this conference. Not everyone here will lay claim to a Christian faith, and that's absolutely fine. Whoever you are, I'm so glad you're here and you're open to inquiry. But I am a Christian, and I'm going to be opening our time with prayer together, asking simply for God to bless our time together wherever we find ourselves on the journey. So let's pray. Lord Jesus, as we begin this conference, we remember that you told us the greatest commandment is to love the Lord our God with all our heart, all our soul, all our strength, and all our mind. And we know we often fall short of that. But today, Lord Jesus, we do offer you our heart, our soul, our strength, and most especially our mind. Thank you for the gift of being able to think, to explore, to reason, and to arrive at truth. And I pray that you'll pour out your spirit on all of those who speak and all of those who listen. And that as we learn from each other, we do so not for our own glory, but so that we can use the minds you've given us to impact the world for your glory. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Could you give a big round of applause for our first speaker who's going to kick us off, Krish Kandaya. Krish, will you come and join me? Oh, there you are.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you. It's lovely to be here. My name's Krish Kandaya. I'm the founding director of Home for Good, which is a fostering and adoption charity. And you might be thinking, well, what's he doing speaking at a conference about apologetics? I hope by the end of my presentation, all will be made clear. I want to take you back a few years when my wife and I and our three kids moved to a town called Harrow. And I know you're thinking Harrow sounds posh, but Harrow wasn't posh, at least the bit where we lived. In fact, it was so not posh that someone once stole our wheelie bin. I mean, how desperate have you got to be to steal someone's wheelie bin? I thought it might be someone with not enough disposable income. Or maybe they had a rubbish job. Oh, anyway, paint you a picture of where we lived. We lived on a dual carriageway in Harrow. And as soon as I moved in, I'm a Christian, I'm passionate about Jesus, and I'd love other people to know about that too. And so I started trying to talk to my neighbours. And my immediate neighbour on the left-hand side, he was a huge guy, and I'm a little guy. When we meet face-to-face downstairs in the book signing, in the coffee break, little plug, you'll see I'm very small. But this guy was huge, and he had one of those big white vans, and he was an industrial fitter in central London. And I went to knock on his door, and I said, "Hello, I've come round for a conversation." And he said, "Well, I don't know you. Why would we have a conversation?" And I said, "Well, okay, then why don't I invite you for a coffee?" And he says, "Well, I've got my own coffee, thank you very much. Why would I want to come and drink yours?" Well, I said, well, so we could get to know each other. "Well, I don't really want to get to know you." Close the door. That was a complete fail of a conversation. And my talk this morning is called Conversations Matter. And it's not what you say. It's not just what you say. It's how you say it. I remember it took a few interventions for me to get to know my neighbour. One of the things that happened was our family bought a really clapped out car. It was a Mitsubishi. And I bought it without ever visiting it or seeing it. I bought it on the phone. And as soon as he said V6, he had me. And I should have done a little bit more investigation into the car. But it was a real clapped out banger. And I remember one day smoke was coming out of all sorts of parts of the car. And so I popped the hood of the car and went in there optimistically with a spanner. And I had no idea what I was going to poke or provoke in this smoking car. But as soon as I popped the hood of my car, my neighbour, the big one, the one with the white van, the one with the muscles and the one with the toolbox, was out of his house as quick as he could be. And he put his head under the bonnet of my car and together we tried to fix the car. And it was as we were trying to fix the car that we actually had a great conversation. And I realised if I ever wanted to talk to my neighbour, I just needed to pop the bonnet of my car and we could speak. I think too often our conversations about Christianity are face-to-face and they're quite argumentative. I've read a lot of books about atheism written by Christians. And they're normally really angry, aren't they? They're trying to destroy atheist arguments, trying to pick them apart line by line. And if you go onto a YouTube channel and you type in Christianity and atheism, you'll get lists like 10 reasons why atheists are stupid and Christians are brilliant. Or if you do it the other way around, I've read a lot of books about Christianity written by atheists. Have you? And I don't recognize the Christians that a lot of the atheists are speaking about. Apparently Christians have switched their brain off. Apparently Christians are the people that kind of bomb abortion clinics. Or Christians, according to Richard Dawkins, are the kinds of people that when Halloween comes, we set up hell houses to scare kids into believing in heaven and hell so that we can tell them that Jesus is the answer. Now, I've never met a Christian like that. Have you? So normally in our conversations between Christians and atheists, it's like it's in a megaphone or in all caps on Twitter. And I'm not sure that's the best mode for our conversation. I think we need a new way forward. And to be honest, that was the reason why I wrote this book, Faithism. I'm going to be doing a seminar in here about it later on this morning after the coffee break. And the book was described as Why Christians and Atheists Have More in Common Than You Think. I think we need to find more common ground rather than just looking at ways that we can shout at each other and lob grenades. I don't know about you, but I know loads of atheists. And most of the atheists I know are pretty reasonable, upstanding people. I meet them at the PTA at my local school. I meet them coaching kids football on a Saturday morning. I meet them when we're trying to do work, trying to solve the refugee crisis. And it's often shoulder by shoulder that we'll have better conversations than face to face shouting at each other. And I think it's probably why you're here today, actually. It's because of Justin and his amazing radio program. Hands up if you are a regular listener to the podcast or the radio program. If you're not, you should be. I love the way that Justin provokes real conversation rather than just people shouting at each other. I love the way that actually at the end of a conversation on Unbelievable, the two speakers are more likely to be friends than enemies. That's a good sign, I would suggest. But I want to take you through just a little other angle on this theme, and I've got some slides that may help us. You see, we often talk about speaking truth. In fact, that's the title of our day today, isn't it? Speaking truth in a post-truth world. And that speaking truth phrase, well, it comes from this phrase, speaking truth to power. And some Christians get very excited about speaking truth to power. But I wonder, in our current climate, in the current political moment that we're in this moment where we're struggling to figure out who we are as a nation and how we all fit together, I wonder whether we need a slight correction to that, a different way forward. The first thing I want to say is, talk is cheap. I'm not convinced people just believe what people say anymore. I remember seeing something on the side of a bus about 350 million quid. I don't know about you. I don't believe that anymore. Are you with me? Truth is contested right now. What's your truth? What's my truth? Interestingly, the kinds of people that used to talk about absolute truth are not the kinds of people that are talking about absolute truth right now. Let me give you an example. This is a quote from... Oh, can you keep it up just for a second? This is a quote from the literary editor of the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani. If you can pronounce that better than me, I'm totally open to suggestions. But Michiko Kakutani. And she's saying, we are living in a world of fake news. Maybe you're familiar with some of the fake news that she's talking about. There is fake science manufactured by climate change deniers and anti-vaxxers. Fake history promoted by Holocaust revisionists and white supremacists. Fake Americans created by Russian trolls and fake followers and likes on social media generated by bots. Now, it used to be conservative Christians that were the loudest voice about speaking about absolute truth. But at the moment, particularly in America, it's more left-leaning people that are arguing there is such a thing as absolute truth. And we are losing credibility as a Christian church around the world when we speak about truth because people don't believe that we actually care about it anymore. You see, when there was a left-leaning president, do you remember Bill Clinton? Do you remember what the church used to say about Bill Clinton? He is not fit for office because of the way that he lives his personal life. Do you remember he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky? Actually, we wouldn't call it an affair. We'd call it an abusive relationship nowadays, wouldn't we? Because he had all the power. And Christians were very loud, weren't we? We need to get this man impeached because he lied, and we need to take down the government because we have an immoral leader. Now, where are the Christian voices speaking up currently about the current president? We're not talking about character. We're not talking about integrity, because the current president has given us, well, what we want. He's given us some power. He's given us a voice on issues like abortion. And so the watching world goes, we're not sure you Christians really care about truth. You just care about power. Do you see what's happening? So we need to be really careful when we start talking about truth. Can you go back to my first slide? Can I have that back up again? Talk is cheap, truth is contested, and power is coveted. We need to check whether we are really pursuing truth at all costs and not just truth on our terms. But I want to throw into the mix a person that we need to learn how to do truth from. How do we have better conversations about truth? Well, this is the verse that's in my mind. Maybe you know it. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus was about more than speaking truth to power, because Jesus' words weren't cheap, were they? Jesus was a man of absolute integrity. He was the Son of God in human flesh. Jesus spoke truth even though it cost him his life. Do you remember when he's in front of Pilate and he could have sucked up to Pilate and sucked up to the power, but instead Jesus, the man with apparently no power, spoke truth to power even though it was going to cost him his life and challenged Pilate's power over him. Jesus didn't claim just to have the truth. He claimed to be the truth. Do you see the difference? We're people of integrity. Our lives speak as much as our words. People won't believe what you say unless they can see what you do. People won't care what you believe unless they see that you care. How can we convince a skeptical world to believe the truth we're speaking? We need to live the truth. Jesus lived an incredibly provocative life so that how he lived spoke as loudly as what he said. And how did Jesus use his power, the power that he was given as the Son of God? Jesus used his power to serve. Think about, he's in the desert and he's tempted by the devil to turn stones into bread, and Jesus refuses. Do you remember? But think about another time when he's in the wilderness and there are 5,000 hungry people. Jesus uses his power to turn a packed lunch from a little boy into enough to feed the crowds. What's the difference? Jesus refuses to use his power for his own benefit. He'll only use it to serve other people. Is that the way the church is marked right now? I'm going to put my next slide up. Here we go. So I want to say that if we follow conversations in the mode of Jesus, we'll see something different. We'll be more effective in our communication. Jesus provoked conversation by the way that he lived. In fact, the most controversial thing that Jesus did were not the miracles, it was the way that he welcomed sinners. Do you remember how the biggest criticism people had about Jesus was he welcomes sinners and eats with them? I wonder, is the way that you live your life provocative in the same way that Jesus is? That in your guest list, who gets invited round for dinner, people will see something of the kingdom come and they'll want to know the Jesus that you love. Jesus provoked conversation. Can you put it up again? You guys, you're so quick. You want to come back to me? Jesus changed the conversation, didn't he? People had all sorts of expectations about what Jesus would care about, the hot button topics that he'd talk about, and he blew them all up by being willing to welcome vulnerable people and show mercy to those that came to him for mercy. And Jesus elevated the conversation. He didn't fit into the stereotypes of his day. Instead, he challenged them with grace and compassion. I believe that's the way that we'll change the conversation in our nation. If we're seen to be the most hospitable people on the planet, people will want to know about our God. To be honest with you, I've had more conversations about faith because of my fostering and adoption than I've had about the fact I've got a PhD in apologetics. It's the live life that makes a provocation. One last picture. Could you put my last one up? It's a picture of a conversation I had recently. Oh, that's the book. Here we go. Come on. There you go. Do you see this? This is a conversation last week. It's taken on the River Thames, and it's taken alongside an atheist friend of mine called Ed. Ed and I have a shared passion. We care about foster children. Ed's an atheist. I'm a Christian. It's as we found common ground, caring for vulnerable children, that we can have a side-by-side conversation that's led Ed into, well, Ed's here. Can you give Ed give you a wave? Can you welcome Ed? It's as we live the kingdom life and care for the vulnerable that real, meaty, Christian, Jesus conversations will occur. We won't always agree, but we'll find common ground. And I believe that way, the name of Jesus will be lifted up and we can really start talking about truth in a post-truth culture. Thank you.
You're listening to Unbelievable, and that was Krish Kandar's opening talk at our 2019 London conference. It took place on the 20th of July. You can watch and hear the whole thing now via our DVD and digital download. Go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. That's the webpage of this show, and click on DVD at the top. The rest of this show is really snippeted highlights from a few sessions from the conference. And up next is Christy Mayer of Oak Hill College. She came on the show earlier this year, you may remember, to talk about her new book, More Truth. And she was one of our plenary speakers in the morning on the subject, Why Aren't We Reaching the Millennials? Talking to a true for you, but not for me generation. And here she is, part of that talk, defining the millennial generation.
So we're going to have a quick look at what is desirable and definable to and about millennials. Now, confession time, I'm afraid I am one. Safe space. Are there any other millennials here at all? Okay, great. Ah, represent. Wonderful. Now, here's a quick millennial lowdown, and oh, how we dislike actually being labelled millennials. So, sorry, guys. Here we go. So, millennials make up the largest generation since the baby boomers of the 1946 to 65. There are 17 million of us in the UK, and we're aged roughly between 19 and 39 years old. And there is a little overlap between us and Gen Z. Most of us are in the universities and the workplace. Formative historical events for us has been 9/11 and the Iraq War. We're the first to kind of be targeted by specific strategic marketing and advertisement. We are the largest generation to date, and trust really just does not come easily for us. Some would say that we're actually the most suspicious of authorities, but I think we're actually most suspicious of other people. According to recent Ipsos Mori research, millennials have significantly lower levels of trust than other previous generations. You know, many of us won't even take any free samples from people who are giving them away because we think there's some kind of a hidden catch. And often we're right. We see through facades, we see through gimmicks. We're distrusting. We view the world through branded signs and symbols. So we recognize that people offer much, but yet they deliver little. And because of this, we're not only distrusting, but we're also highly skeptical. Now, skepticism is nothing new. In its earliest form, it reaches back to Xenophanes in about 500 BC, before it was more kind of formally cemented in two academic schools. Sorry, a bit of an intro to history of philosophy here. Academic skepticism and Pyrrhonism. And I think it's probably Pyrrhonism that we're seeing a bit of a trend in millennials today. That's probably most prevalent in everyday attitudes. That's in order to achieve mental tranquility, we should suspend judgment. And for many today, that means disengagement with key issues. Or another strand emerges from a controlling subconscious cognitive paradigm. And that's where what we do is we think that there can be made equally compelling arguments for or against a particular issue. After all, you know, who would actually be so arrogant to say that they know the truth? For millennials, there are many different ways, and it may not even be possible to know the way in the first place. More on that later. We're in limbo. Millennials really struggle with decision making, and this is partly why. So much of this distrust and skepticism carries over into other areas of life. Relativism ranks highly. Truth is seen as a culturally conditioned product of our environments. You know, it leads to statements such as, "This is my truth. Tell me yours." There is no absolute truth. and we were actually really going to struggle to persuade them otherwise. Absolutist claims led to the destruction of the World Trade Center and sent soldiers and civilians to their death in the Iraq War. Absolute truth claims are dangerous and they're divisive. Absolute claims pertaining to reality are seen as just another option, another window upon reality. And you think it's absolute, but actually it's just one other way. Who's making the absolute truth claim now? Millennials invest in social issues. We want to contribute in some way in order to make this world a better place. We're natural advocates. But as we have so many options open to us, most experience higher levels of anxiety. I can attest to that. When I was 18 years old, I remember applying to universities, and I received these wonderful, like, juicy, thick, fat white A4 envelopes in the post containing acceptance letters to all of my first choices, actually, which was, I was astounded by. And you'd think that this was a really, really good thing. But I cried. And family members came in, and they're like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, I just don't know which one to choose. There's such a paralysis. There's a paradox of choice which leads us to either fight or flight mode. We're always in the present. And technology doesn't help with this either. Social media facilitates this presentism by keeping us in the now and by focusing on current events in real time. Millennials possess a poor sense of historical situatedness, and many of us are actually too uncomfortable to even consider future events. Putting it quite crudely, we are anxious, distrusting skeptics, highly motivated and engaged individuals with a pressing sense of the now who really, really want to make this world a better place. And many of us are missing from our churches. A significant number of those outside the church are deeply concerned about us Christians. More than one third say that their negative perceptions are a result of moral failures in church leadership. 87% say they see Christians as hypocritical, 85% as judgmental, 70% as insensitive to others. Perhaps they aren't wrong. Maybe they're missing for very good reasons. And we not only struggle with drawing millennials in, but we also find keeping them rather challenging. Why is that? One Barna Group article states, millennials need help learning how to apply their hearts and minds to today's cultural realities. Millennials need guidance on engaging culture meaningfully and from a distinctly Christian perspective. Some of our church cultures, just to draw a bit of a crude generalization, can lead either towards intellectualism or emotionalism. It's either about the emotional experience on the Sunday over content or making doctrinal pronouncements which bypass the hearts and minds of those listening. Both are biblically deficient. The Ipsos Mori research further reveals that 66% of millennials outside of the church trust priests, but they don't see how their truth claims are personally relevant. One of the biggest millennial challenges for those in and outside of the church centers on relevance. If all churches are promoting is personal experience, then millennials may come for a little while until they find something else that makes them feel even better. We're used to brand marketing, so if Jesus is presented as a commodity, we'll use him until it stops working or something better comes along. Or if all churches are doing is promoting an abstract intellectualism, millennials will really struggle to connect God with their own lives. Theologian Russell Moore said it boils down to this. The biggest hindrance to the advancement of the church, especially within this millennial generation, is the bubble of the Christian subculture. How many of us are actually friends with millennials? And remember, it's a broad age group. How many of us, in the name of cultural engagement, perhaps millennials amongst us, enjoy hipster coffee shops and alternative, you know, folky bands? But actually, rather than doing this with your non-Christian mates, the awkward reality is that you're just hanging out with your Christian friends. You may be socially engaged and use words like authentic, real, but really you're just living out the Christian subculture, the bubble, which you're trying to upend by showing that Christians can be cool. Or perhaps a little bit closer to home, how many of us write or talk about apologetics or write articles online, link them, you know, with quotes, favorite gospel definitions from my heroes on Twitter, but have no meaningful offline relationships with those who don't yet know Christ? There'll be those of us here who know the minutiae of every church controversy, yet have no meaningful non-Christian contacts. Now, you may not fit into either of these brackets, but the challenge still stands. How many of us know and love someone who doesn't yet know and love Christ? Why not? Now, there are distinct emphases on what it means to be a millennial just as much as there are for Gen X and baby boomers. But engaging with a true for me, true for you generation requires one thing: truth himself.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, you can hear the rest of Christie's talk on addressing truth to a millennial generation by getting hold of the DVD or digital download of Unbelievable, the Conference 2019. This, a special edition of your usual show with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you a few selected highlights from this year's London Conference, which took place just over a month ago. We've got more great speakers for you coming in the next part of today's programme, and we'll be back soon.
The UK's leading faith debate show is coming to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Join me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable Live in LA on Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of October. On Friday night, I'll be joined by renowned Christian thinker Professor John Lennox and LA's leading secular talk show host Dave Rubin to debate God, faith and atheism. Then Saturday is Unbelievable the Conference, a day to learn from Christian thinkers from the UK and USA on how to make the case for Christ, featuring Sean McDowell, J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, Brian Brodison, and from the UK, John Lennox, Ruth Jackson, and me, your host, Justin Brierley. Book your place for the big conversation on faith this October at unbelievable.live.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. Unbelievable brings you conversations on faith, philosophy, theology, science and more every week. And every year here in the UK, we do a special conference where we invite thinkers from all over the world to talk about how Christians can have more confident conversations. So on today's show, we're making room from the normal format dialogue and debate to hear some highlights of this year's London conference. Once again, though, a reminder, we will be out in the USA this October. Join us for Unbelievable Live in LA in Costa Mesa, a live show on Friday night with John Lennox and Dave Rubin in conversation, followed by an all-day conference. Again, get your tickets at unbelievable.live for the 11th and 12th. Of October. In fact, I was just out in the USA for a summer break with my family out in California, got to meet some old friends, people from Reasons to Believe who are based out there, had some great beach time as well. We were based for some of the time at Newport Beach. What a lovely part of the world. I got to visit downtown LA, some of the delights of that. Palm Springs Aerial Tramway was one of the day trips we did. Great fun. Plus some theme parks, of course. We got to go and visit friends as well in Northern California. Even got the joy of catching a Giants game at San Francisco in the Oracle Stadium, which was a first for me. I've never even really watched a game of baseball, let alone experienced it live. So that was quite something. And we got over to Yosemite National Park as well. What a stunning place that was to visit for a day. Wonderful redwood forests and just some of those vistas and views and waterfalls, just absolutely stunning. Anyway, lots of new friends made as well, because I was pleased to speak at two churches on two of the weekends that we were out there. Christ Church of the Valley, or CCV, SoCal, as they're also known. And Jeff Vines is the pastor and a friend of the show. In fact, he's going to be speaking at our LA conference. And it's just a wonderful church, great people. I spoke at four services there on why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. They let me off the fifth service. This, as you can tell, is quite a big church, and showed the video, I think, of one of the earlier services. But signed a lot of books there. It was great to meet people who'd never heard of the show, but people who had as well. And I also got to talk at Riverview Church as well on one weekend, further down towards San Diego. Lots of new friends made, as I say, in both cases. And I've actually just posted up on our Unbelievable Facebook and Twitter accounts that talk I gave at CCV. It's also on our YouTube channel. So do go to the website of the show for links to the social media and the YouTube channel, premierchristianradio.com/ Unbelievable. Also going to include it on the next edition of the newsletter from Unbelievable. That's a brilliant way to keep in touch with content from the show too. You can subscribe to it from the webpage too. Look out for that, the video of me talking about why I'm still a Christian. Okay, back to this week's show. We're bringing you highlights from Unbelievable 2019 in London. We're going to be hearing some snippets as we go from Bruxy Cavey on creating confident conversations, Sarah Lumgair on what Muslims believe about Christians. But let's start off this section of the show with a little bit from Paul Spears, his seminar on how can I know Christianity is true, building and deploying a reasonable faith. One of the Apologetics Masterclass seminars led by Biola Apologetics.
This conversation isn't about winning arguments. It's not about winning at all, as a matter of fact, but about living a life that's in concert with what is ultimately important. To say you know means you understand what it means to be a human person and that you're living according to that. So it's not going to be about power. It's not going to be about control. It's not going to be about taking advantage. It's a journey that necessitates a lot, and I mean a lot, of humility and reliance on God as you refine your understanding of the world you live in. I've been teaching now for, as I said, 20 years, and students have radically changed over the last 5 years. I mean, they have changed, you know, from 20 years ago, but there has been this exponential change about the kind of questions that they need to ask themselves, or they feel they need to ask themselves. And they really don't know what it means to think of themselves as a human. They don't know if they have to make strong decisions about their sexuality. They don't know what it means to think about their gender. They don't know what it means to struggle with questions of fidelity. They just don't have any idea where to start, because the world is constantly talking to them about everything being a wide open field, and that as long as you don't get in someone else's way, you're okay. As a matter of fact, the worst thing that you can do in our culture right now is actually tell somebody that you believe something that then causes them supposed harm, right? But the reality is that if you actually want to say you know something, that means that you disagree with something else. And so you have to come to grips with the fact that your understanding is going to put you at odds with other understanding. We do this all the time, right? You buy something at the store, somebody hands you change. You look at the change and you say, that's not right. Right? We do that all the time. That seems normal to us. But there are lots of implications with somebody when you say to them, I think the thing that you're doing is bad for you. Even if it's true. So we're going to be wrestling with that. Okay. So here's what Dallas Willard says, one of my favorite philosophers. We are under the crushing weight of the secular outlook that permeates or pressures every thought we have today. Sometimes it even forces those who self-identify as Christian teachers to set aside Jesus' plain statements about the reality and total relevance of the kingdom of God and replace them with philosophical speculations whose only recommendation is their constancy with a modern mindset. Every day, constantly, so much so that we don't think about it, right? We don't think about the fact that we have, air pressure on us all the time. We don't think about that, because it's just a part of how we live. We don't think about how much oxygen we have around. We just know we have it until, you know, you try to climb the Alps and then you realize there's not as much oxygen up there. Then you think about it, right? It becomes part of how you live your life. You don't notice that there are differences. And what happens in our culture is we're not thinking about actually the most important questions. We're allowing people to craft our ideas, to be influenced by things in such a way that they overwhelm us and we don't even know it. So we're going to do something today. We're going to actually wrestle with this notion of knowledge. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about knowledge. And knowledge is often defined in a very simplistic way, shorthand, as justified true belief. All right? So justified true belief. Think of knowledge here as a three-legged stool. You take one of those pieces out, and the stool doesn't stand anymore. So we're going to walk through definitionally what these look like. Okay, so what does it mean to be justified? Justification is when you have sufficient and proper evidence for what you hold to be a belief. So you have to have the right sort of evidence. Justification isn't something that just sits out there and you say, oh, I'm justified. Why are you justified? If you're using the wrong reasons to justify yourself, then the likelihood of them being false is very high, right? Your beliefs to be actually not true. You have to know why you know the idea. I could tell you right now, I'm a brain surgeon. I am a doctor, but I'm not that kind of doctor. And you would want certain kinds of evidence to know that I would be good as a brain surgeon, right? That'd be important, wouldn't it? And so you'd look for certain kinds of things that would give evidence to you. And if I would be like, you know, not knowing any of the implements that you were supposed to use as you went into brain surgery. No hair has nothing to do with maybe Ken. No, see, that's a bad kind of justification. Hair or not hair, whether you have it or not, it makes you know that you're smarter because your brain is firing at a higher level than others. But that's a totally different thing. That's been proven by science. So can give a perfect example, right? That is not justification. You cannot be justified to hold that belief to be true based upon that criteria.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
That was Paul Spears, and you can hear him again in the final panel Q&A discussion at the end of today's show. But do make sure to catch the rest of that seminar that you just heard a little snippet of on the DVD and digital download of this year's conference. We also ran a stream on other religions at this year's conference. Sarah Lumgair, who regularly engages with Muslims in dialogue and debate, spoke on her own first-hand experience on the subject, what do Muslims believe about Christians responding to Islam with truth and love? And here's just some of her opening up a few of the misconceptions she's often encountered from Muslims about Christians.
Hollywood. This is an obvious one. If you think that the West represents Christianity, then everything you see in the films, from revealing clothes to the love scenes, all of that is assumed to be Christian. Deaths. Now, some Muslims believe that we have an appalling and a very immoral way to looking at death. We have abortion in our country. We don't want our babies. When people are getting elderly, we are now introducing euthanasia. And they're saying you have no compassion, you're immoral, you don't look after your elderly. This is not right. Family. Many Muslims look at the way and notice, I haven't said anything theological yet. This is sometimes cultural from Muslims who have not lived in the West and have moved to the West or have had attitudes that have come over from their culture. So family, they believe that we are very, very individualistic, which is wrong. We can do whatever we like, whenever we like. We think Jesus has died for us, so it doesn't matter what we do. And we don't respect our family. We don't take into consideration the responsibilities that we have to family. This is another problem. And church, and even when Muslims become Christians, church isn't family to them. I've heard from a number of converts who have said they came to church, they were excited, they've become a Christian, And they thought, great, I've got this new family. They're saying, now you're part of Christ's family. That's wonderful. And then they say, see you next Sunday. And then they're like, what about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday? I've been used to going to the mosque every day or praying every day. You know, what am I going to do with this time? Where is my family? I've left absolutely everything. So this is an issue. And many, it's really sad when we see converts to Christianity who have felt without family. And that's one of the major reasons that converts go back into Islam. And we often say that if a convert hasn't remained in Christianity for about 5 years, well, 5 years is pretty much the marker when we know, okay, they're rooted and grounded. And often we get so excited, yes, a convert, go give your testimony, go do this. And there's so much happening inside that it's a really difficult challenge. Hate. This is slightly theological, but many Muslims think that we actually hate them deep down inside. That we're smiling at them with our lovely Western polite faces, but deep down we really hate them. Now this hate is theological because it says that the Christians and Jews are friends with one another, but also in terms of foreign policy that plays a massive part in the way Muslims think about how we believe about what we believe about them, the fact that we hate them. And this I've heard over and over again. They think Christians lie. They think we're lying when we say we don't worship three gods. They think that we're lying when we say we actually love them. They think that's a lie. They think we're not very religious, that we don't follow Jesus. Jesus was a Muslim, according to the Quran. He prayed like a Muslim. He did all the things. He followed the laws like Muslims follow the laws. And they say, we don't really follow Jesus. We just say it in part, but we don't really mean it. We don't actually pray. Muslims go to the mosque. They say they pray 5 times a day. It's very, very regimented. But we never see you Christians pray. So this is just a perception. And of course, the closer they get to a Christian, the more these things are dispelled. But if they're never close to a Christian, or they assume that everybody in the West is a Christian, and so what they see is Christianity, then this is an issue. That you don't know your Bible. Many Muslims will show you videos of 6-year-olds who've memorized the Quran, are saying it off the top of their head in Arabic, and they say, you can't even recite one book of your New Testament. How can you tell me that you love Jesus? How can you tell me that you love the Bible? You can't recite anything. Well, we have a very different approach to scripture. We actually look at it, we read it, we study it, and we carry it around on our phones these days. And it's good to memorize, but it's understanding what it is, which is the important thing, whereas in Islam, it's the reciting that gives you the blessing. So you don't necessarily need to understand what you're reciting as long as you're reciting it. And that we don't fast. I think we all know about the month of Ramadan. And because Muslims don't see the same with us, they just think that we don't fast. And it's just an explanation that these things are hidden. This is the way Jesus has designed it. I think we don't respect Mary. Have you heard this before? Some people have heard this before. You don't respect Mary. You don't cover your hair like Mary covered your hair. Look, we have a whole book in the Quran dedicated to Mary, Surah Maryam, which is chapter 19 of the Quran. You don't have a book dedicated to Mary. You don't really like Mary. And plus, you believe that God had relations with Mary. This is really disrespectful. We're going to answer that a little later on. But these are things that I've heard time and time again. You're not modest. I remember going to a Christian-Muslim dialogue and I had a knee-length skirt. And I've made it. I think when I first started Christian-Muslim dialogues, I covered up completely. And I wanted to be really respectful. But then I realized I'm living in England. I have freedom. Why am I doing this when I have freedom? As long as I'm respectful and modest to the standards of my society, then that should be enough. I don't want to take on the rules that God hasn't given to me. I don't need to do that. I want to live in the freedom while honoring Christ. But this was a big issue about modesty. And problem with slavery. Now, I, as a black person, have heard this. I used to hear it time and time again until I started challenging back. but that how can you be a Christian and you're black? Don't you know what happened to your ancestors? Don't you know that Christianity has a problem with slavery and racism? They say this because if they've been brought up in the West, it's mainly Western Muslims who say this, then they've been taught about the history of the transatlantic slave trade, and there's this perception that Islam is for everybody, and so Islam doesn't have an issue with this. Whereas if we know anything about the trans-Saharan slave trade, which existed much longer, is much older, and actually treated black people worse, and that's a completely 2-3 hour different talk. But Islam really does have an issue with slavery, and it's still going on today in places like Mauritania and Chad and parts of the Middle East. And so that's come up a few times.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable, a highlight show today of some snippets from Unbelievable, the Conference 2019. Well, you can hear more from Sarah getting into the theological objections that Muslims often have with Christianity. You can do that by getting hold of the DVD and digital download. Pre-order it now. It'll be coming your way if you do so in September. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Click on the DVD link at the top of the page. Well, a few weeks ago, we featured Bruxy Cavey on the show. He was a speaker at this year's conference, and we're going to get to hear some of the listener feedback to his show and other shows from over the summer from next week onwards. But here he is in full flow during his seminar at this year's conference titled Creating Better Conversations: How to Talk About Jesus with Sinners, Saints, and Skeptics.
You know the story in Acts 17 where the Apostle Paul speaks to the Areopagus in Athens, and he has that amazing way of starting his sermon. Do you remember the sermon? He says, "You people of Athens, I've walked around, I've looked, I've observed." We don't know how long he was in Athens, by the way. The earlier part of the chapter says he was there for some time, engaging in discussions in the marketplace. He could have been there for days, weeks, months. We don't know, but we do know that he used his time wisely to observe, to engage in conversation, to ask questions, to learn. So when he finally got his chance to speak, he was speaking from a point of respect because he knew their culture well. And sometimes we think, I guess as a boy, he studied Greek culture. Well, he had time right there to study, and to study it by learning from people themselves and to walk around and observe real time. What's happening here? What do people believe? So he finally gets a chance to open his mouth, and he says, I've been observing, and I notice that you have this altar with an inscription. What's the inscription? To an unknown God. The next words out of his mouth blow my mind. He says, and so that which you worship, though ignorantly, this I proclaim to you. What? Wow. Yes, amen. Do we know what we're amening? He says, that which you worship, you already worship the God I'm about to tell you about. You just don't know it yet. Now, he doesn't conclude from that. Therefore, you don't need to learn about Jesus because all paths lead up the mountain. All religions are basically the same. And so, you already worship God, I worship the same God, tomato, tomato, have a good day, and leave. No, 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 they still need to hear the gospel, but rather than see them as the enemy, he sees them as people reaching out because, why? Because the Holy Spirit's already been there, and he's already been at work. So Paul asked questions, had conversations, observed their religious practices, and went, wait a second, I see evidence that my God got here before I did. Surprise. And he's been at work even in their pagan culture. Earlier in the chapter, it says that Paul's spirit, when he saw all the idols, was provoked within him, is how one translation says. His spirit was provoked within him. The Greek literally means to be pierced with something that's sharp and stabby. It's like when he saw the idolatry, it hurt. He felt the pain. And so when he finally gets a chance to preach, you think he could have just wanted to vent emotionally, get it off his chest, and call that holiness. Paul's sermon could have started, if he wanted a cathartic release, with, men of Athens, you heathen horde, how dare you offend the God of Israel? You are a stench in his nostrils. It could have begun that way, and Paul would have felt really great about it. But instead, he observed where God was at work, and he began where they're at with great honor and respect, and he began to exegete their own culture right back to them. He didn't exegete scripture. He exegeted their own story. He said, so this which you worship in ignorance, this is what I'm going to teach you about. This is what I'm going to proclaim to you. You are worshiping without realizing the God I'm about to. We're already worshiping the same God. You just don't know enough yet to complete the journey. He acknowledges God's already been at work there. And so he then goes on to say, if you read the passage, that even the fact that this was an altar to the unknown God and not a temple to the unknown God is significant. He says, gods, your gods, the pagan gods, need temples for sacrifice, and you have to go to the temple to meet with them. He says, our God is bigger than this. Our God does not need sacrifices. Jesus was the last sacrifice. Now we're going to be living sacrifices wherever we go, as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 12:1. He says, the true God I'm telling you about, which apparently you already worship, he says, you're right not to build him a temple, because he doesn't need a temple. You're right not to kill animals and make sacrifices to this God, because he doesn't need sacrifices. He's already intuitively implanted within your heart some truth, and I'm here to help complete that truth, that conversation. And he walks through their own religious system and talks about how it points to Jesus. We always start where people are at, but then we walk with them toward Jesus. So I would say that in evangelism, we bring the gospel to people, but we never bring God to people. We never bring God. He's already been there. Therefore, the first work of evangelist is to observe and ask questions. This is our role. So if you say, I'm not sure how to start a gospel conversation, I'm not sure what to say up front, the first thing is to ask questions. Become genuinely, spiritually curious. And if you're not, if you just want to hear yourself preach, pray and ask God to make you genuinely, spiritually curious about what your friends, your coworkers, your family really believe. And then ask them lots of questions and follow-up questions. Well, if you believe this, how do you reconcile with that? Because earlier you told me this. Okay, well, what about this? And you'll learn wonderful things about them. Then when you do have a chance to share, you're sharing into the known rather than speaking into the unknown. You're engaged in a real relationship. It's a beautiful place to start. So at the Meeting House, we encourage people to simply engage in spiritual conversations, pre-gospel conversations, to learn and ask questions. And then you may even discern who wants to have a conversation about Jesus and who's just not interested.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I sat in for most of that one with Bruxy Cavey, and it really was such a great session. So practical, so well theologically grounded as well. Well worth catching in full on the DVD or digital download. This is Justin Brierley on Unbelievable Today, bringing you highlights from our London conference from July. And in the final part of today's show, we're going to hear some of the final panel Q&A that took place on the day. A question on what do I say to my gay friend kicked off that panel Q&A, and you'll hear the response in the next section of today's programme. That's all coming up soon. Do make sure to check out more from the show. Get hold of that DVD and download at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show, bringing you a selection of highlights from Unbelievable 2019. Hundreds of Unbelievable listeners gathered at Methodist Central Hall, Westminster, on the 20th of July, and we're going to have an excerpt from the final panel Q&A coming up shortly. Now, after today's show, on the profile, Megan Cornwell will be speaking to Bernard Hibbs of the Christian community, the Bruderhof, about their unusual lifestyle. That was the subject of a recent article in Premier Christianity magazine and also a BBC documentary. She's also talking to Philip North, the Bishop of Burnley. That's at 4 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio or on the Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, over the summer break, my news feed was filled with stories of two particular high-profile Christians, Josh Harris and Marty Sampson renouncing their faith. Saw a lot of hot takes on those stories, some helpful, some not so helpful. I did actually share one video I found quite helpful from Mike Licona about how he dealt with doubt and addressing Marty Sampson, I think, in particular in that video. I also think Ruth Jackson has written a great piece on preparing young people for doubt in light of those stories. I put that on the latest Unbelievable newsletter. But I'm hoping to actually get, hopefully, one or both of them, Marty and Josh, on at some point to talk through their journey with someone. I always think that talking these things through, getting it from the horse's mouth, is the best way of doing things. But in the next 2 weeks, we will be looking at this issue from different angles. Now, Josh Harris, before this latest announcement, had been best known as a pastor and author of the book I Kissed Dating Goodbye, which was very influential in the evangelical purity culture movement of the late 90s. Well, he recently released a video documentary called I Survived I Kissed Dating Goodbye, in which he effectively apologised for the book. Now, we're not going to have Josh himself on the show. He's taking a break from media at the moment. But the documentary producer, Jessica van der Wingard, will be joining me to talk about Josh's journey and purity culture in conversation with Sean McDowell. Now, his father, Josh McDowell, was a leading figure in the 80s and 90s purity culture movement, True Love Waits, that kind of thing. So they're going to be debating, is it time to kiss goodbye to Christian purity culture on next week's show? That should be a really fascinating one, as well as having a little look at Josh Harris's own recent, obviously, statement, so that where he appears to have moved away from Christianity altogether and has announced divorce from his wife as well. Another exciting show coming up in the schedule the week after, when it comes to deconstruction and doubt. Well, well-known Christian musicians Michael and Lisa Gunga have been quite open about their own journey on that front in recent years. And Lisa Gunga will be joining me to talk about that, along with Alisa Childers, who's a Christian apologist who has her own journey with doubt, but who came out of it with a more conservative faith, I think it's fair to say, than Lisa has. So they'll be joining me to talk about doubt and deconstruction, two shows that I think will reflect in quite important ways on these recent stories we've heard from prominent Christian leaders. So look out for those on your radio set or your podcast feed over the next couple of weeks. And of course, we'll be talking about those and all kinds of other issues at Unbelievable Live in LA again. If you're able to come out to Costa Mesa on the 11th and 12th of October, going to be back in the USA for an unmissable Friday evening live show and Saturday conference featuring people like John Lennox, Dave Rubin, and a variety of Christian thinkers. Tell your friends, tell your church, come on out to Unbelievable Live in LA if you're in the California area or can get there somehow from wherever you are in the North America region. That Friday night dialogue, by the way, between John Lennox and Dave Rubin will form part of the second season of The Big Conversation, which actually kicks off this coming Friday, the 13th of September. We'll be releasing, as the first part of that new season, the video of that long-awaited discussion between Alistair McGrath and Brett Weinstein that we recorded in London. We played a highlights promo video, actually, at this year's Unbelievable Conference, and we're going to be releasing that online soon as well to give you a taster of what's coming up in Season 2 this autumn from The Big Conversation.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Now, traditionally, we always end our Unbelievable conferences with a panel Q&A. And this year, I was joined on stage by Lorcan Price and Lawrence Wilkinson from ADF International, Craig Hazen and Paul Spears from Biola, Christy Mayer of Oak Hill College, Sarah Lumger, who works for London City Mission, and Tim Ulford of Limitless, who are the youth arm of Elim Church. Now, you're not going to hear the whole of this again. It's just a selected highlight of the panel Q&A. But here's some of what happened when we sat down to take questions from the Unbelievable audience at this year's conference.
Let's get some thoughts. I'll start at the end, Christy, with you. Any highlights? We'll keep them brief, but any highlights from what you did today and the people you spoke to?
Oh, so many. I think the biggest one for me, actually, was talking with a couple after the first session. You came up to me, I don't know if you're still here, if you are. Are you? Yes, you are. I see you. You came up to me and said, this really helps us to relate to our sons as a result. I just thought, yes.
Great.
That is what we're about. So thank
Fantastic.
You.
Tim?
My highlight is feeling painfully underdressed in this panel. My highlight was just in the last session, actually, in the youth stream, we got the parents, the youth leaders, the church leaders, the folks in the room to engage. And just I feel like I learned a lot in hearing their experience of why young people reject faith and leave the church. So that was good for me.
Brilliant.
Logan.
There have been so many, and I agree with the first speaker. One lady approached me and said, "Why should we listen to a lawyer talking about faith?" I said, "My wife asked me that question all the time." I think just the broad range of views here today, the questions we've been confronted with, it's clear that people have thought very deeply about this and that they're confronted in so many ways in their own life with how to communicate faith in an increasingly difficult environment, I think it would be fair to say.
Great. Paul?
Yeah, I've been really encouraged with the fact that people are hungry for answers and are looking hard to find them in a world where people don't believe that there are really answers, that you can really go do whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. They're hearing, no, there are ways in which to navigate the complexities of this world and actually live and flourish for God.
Great.
Yeah, two things. First, meeting some wonderful new people. But also during the coffee break time, seeing everybody kind of rush down and mingle, I got the sense that you folks kind of look at this as a safe haven, a place where you can come together to enjoy each other's company in the whole realm of ideas. I think there's a safe place needed for that. But it felt like a big family reunion getting together. So I can see that this is much more than a learning situation. This is truly an intimate fellowship situation too.
Sarah.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I feel like it's, for me, it feels like family coming home. I really appreciated in the session that I did hearing the different situations in which Islam comes up and how to deal with it, whether it be in schools, whether it's at work, what's happening in Malaysia even, what's happening in parts of Africa, just the wide range that the topic touches and how we deal with these things with a little bit of tact.
Great. Lawrence.
Yeah, and so my seminar was on can we bring our faith to work, and on a straw poll I think the vast majority felt that no, you can't, or certainly that the legal protections weren't as strong, and I think hopefully by the end of the session it seemed that more people understood actually we have really strong freedoms, and that seemed to be encouraging, and I hope that that leads to people being able to have more conversations about their faith in the workplace, which is always great to see. Yeah.
Great stuff. Well, thank you all for all of your contributions today, and now's a chance to get some questions in the final part of the day. So, as I said, we're going to start in that corner of the room. So if the rover mic could be positioned in that corner. And anyone with questions, please do raise your hand, and we'll take a couple as we can from this section of the audience. I can see one hand at least in this over here and another over there. Maybe we'll start over there, yes, at the far end, the lady with her hand up. Thank you.
Yeah, I had an incident at Wimbledon this year, and I was talking to she was a mutual friend of the group that we were in the members' enclosure, and we were having drinks and everything. She had a bit to drink, but as I was sharing, I said, "I've got to share my faith because I knew how needy she was, and I have a real heart for the LGBT community." But I had no idea that I was going to be thrown into the deep end. And so as I said, I just said, you're a tennis coach. And I said, God has really created you for purpose. It's amazing what you're doing with training these young people. And she said, do you go to church? I said, yes, I do. So she said, well, what church do you go to? I said, oh, we have all kinds of people in our church. Everybody's welcome, and we're a very warm and loving church. And as I was telling her about the church, she said, so can I come? I said, yes, everybody is welcome. And so her dad, she was like in her early 30s, her dad was sitting across the table, and he said, what are you two talking about? She said, I want to go to Denise's church. And he said, oh, why is that? And she said, because she was just saying that everybody's welcome, and I want to bring my partner, and would your church marry me with my partner? And I said, everybody is welcome. And and then she said, I can come to your church with my partner. And I said, we're very loving church. And as she was talking and going on with her questions, and which I was trying to avoid, I just felt the Holy Spirit saying, yeah, so what are you going to say? Mm. And what are you going to do? Mm. And inside I'm saying, no, please don't come to my church. Because, You know, we're just thinking like, of course we want to welcome them, but how do we...
I love the fact that you're so honest about the reality when you're having a conversation with someone. This is kind of something probably all of us are familiar with, that tension between the grace we want to show people in terms of the welcome of the church, but often when a church does, you know, have a standard to which they call people with when it comes to sexuality. And I think we've seen this dotted across all of our seminars today in one form or another, this issue coming out in different ways. So who am I going to pick on for this one? Tim, do you have any words of advice for our dear friend here who just doesn't know what to say in that moment?
Thanks, Justin. I love you too. I would just like to know, if I answer your question, do I get an invite to the Wimbledon members enclosure? That's, yeah. Okay, so I'm aware that there will be people from different theological persuasions in the room, but I'm aware also that this is a really prevalent question for many of us. And so what I would like to do, if it's okay, is try to answer that in a way that may not speak specifically to that conversation, but will speak to the issue, and I hope help all of us to engage in that conversation. Earlier this year, I was in I was doing some panels like this with other ministers in schools, and it was that kind of guerrilla Christian thing, very much like this, but nobody's a Christian, or very few are Christians. Put the microphone out there, ask them about a Christian. I did three panels in 2 days across two different schools, and in every one of those panels, this same question was brought up. Not quite as fluently and eloquently as you brought it to us, but questions, phrases like, what does God think of gays, was a question that was asked. That's an easy question to answer. He loves them, just like he loves me and he loves you, but that's not what they were getting at.
Right.
And so here's how I answered the question. I tried to take a little bit of a cue from Jesus.
Okay.
and answer the question with a question, because what I wanted to challenge was the underlying assumption that love is love and we should all be entitled to follow the thing that is a natural desire within us. And how can we possibly say to someone that it is not appropriate for them to pursue their natural desire? And so my thinking on this subject leads me to believe that we say that because it sounds nice and it feels inclusive, but none of us actually ultimately, when you push the question to a logical conclusion, believe what we're saying. So I asked them to consider, hey guys, can I just ask you, is everything that we desire good for us, you know, by a way of a show of hands? So I, you know, gave an example. So for example, if I desire to eat fish and chips every night, I may desire it, but is it good for me? Well, no, we're all in agreement. I'm trying to find a point of agreement. Okay, well, let me ask you this question, I said to them. Is everything that we desire to do with our bodies good for us? You know, same point of agreement. Well, no, of course not everything we desire, you know, in the fish and chips example, for a case in point. Okay, and then, you know, drawing a little closer to the question that's been asked, okay, is everything that we desire to do sexually with our body good for us? And now they're kind of umming and ahhing because they know where I'm going and they don't want to agree with me. And so I say, okay, well, let me give you an example. What if a 35-year-old fell in love with a 15-year-old? It's not so different in age. And consensually, they decided that they wanted to have a sexual relationship with one another. It was consensual. They're in love with each other. They desire it very much. Is that right or is it wrong? And I know, with them being 15, that 35 feels like their granddad. So, of course, they're like, no, that's wrong. That's disgusting. What are you talking about? And so I said, oh, it's interesting. So what you are telling me is that it's not always what we desire that we should be able to pursue, that somewhere along the line there should be something external. So I asked them, and I gave them another example. I said, I'm a married man. If as a married man I desire to sleep with somebody who's not my wife and they desire to sleep with me and it was a consensual relationship and we very much desired it, would that be right or would that be wrong? And they said to me, well, that would be wrong. And so I said to them, it's interesting because what you've told me is that not everything you desire to do with your body sexually is right. So how do we discern therefore, what is right and what is wrong. If you're telling me actually it's not the thing we most naturally desire that should govern what we pursue with our bodies sexually, then what does it? Is it the government? Well, this is a generation who's cynical about politicians and leaders and the adults who voted for them. And so, of course, they say, well, no, of course not the government. I say, well, is it the law? Is it teachers? Is it your parents? Are they the ones with the authority to tell you what's right or wrong to do with your body? Is it just the pervading cultural narrative? Because that doesn't seem like a solid foundation onto which to build your sexuality to me, because what's right today could be wrong tomorrow, and what's wrong today could be right tomorrow. Will you just be a sheep and follow what everyone else says? Well, no. And so now I'm able to kind of land my point a little bit, where I say to them, well, here's how I make a decision about what's right or wrong sexuality. I submit to the one who I believe created sex and made it for us and gave it to us for our good. And as he gave it to us, he said to us, here's how to use it in the very best way, the way that is good for you, the way which will bring you joy and fulfillment, and the way that is most honoring to me. And so without answering the question directly, because what I know is an incendiary comment, which will light the touch paper, is to say, actually, as a Christian, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, and homosexuality is sinful. Okay, that might be my theological point of view, but I cannot use that in a conversation with a young person, and you cannot use that in your conversation with your friend, because you've lost them. And so what I'm trying to do is to draw the question to its logical conclusion.
Thank you. Maybe one comment from Craig.
I think that was right on the money, and I just want to help out with just a practical tip on this, because when we go to secular university campuses and we're talking about something completely unrelated, this is a derailing question for everything. It just sends the whole discussion into a different direction. And so we've learned some techniques that kind of bring it back into the right direction. And here's one. My oldest brother is gay, and my wife and I were, and we have a great relationship. My wife and I were driving through his neck of the woods in Los Angeles. He lives in West Hollywood. And we say, hey, we should stop by and see my brother Steve. And so we stop by. Well, we didn't know that it was like the Gay Pride Parade Day. It wasn't on our calendar, but it was on his. And so we stop by to see him. There's cars everywhere. They're having a big afterglow party at his house. And so we wander in, and it's just jammed, you know, with the Hollywood gay elites, you know. And my brother, he sees me come in. He goes, oh, Craig, hey, everybody, it's my fundamentalist brother from Orange County, California.
Wow.
If you know anything about geography, Orange County is actually being worse than being fundamentalist anyway. So because it was their like sphere of influence, and they didn't mind really engaging me in conversation. I was surprised that people would go, so you're a fundamentalist, are you? You know? So, and the question, this one fellow really engaged me with, and a lot of people were listening, and he goes, so tell me, why is it that you fundamentalists have such a problem with our lifestyle? And I go, well, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know about the fundamentalism thing or what I believe or what other people believe in the church. I'm sure there's a whole spectrum of it. But let me ask you this. Let's say if there is a God, and if he, she, it, or they, because I wanted to sound open, and if he, she, it, or they had something to say about human sexual practices, would that make a difference to you? Well, I don't know about that. No, just it's a hypothetical, I understand. And so if there is a God, and if that God has had something to say about human sexual practices, would that make a difference? Well, I don't know. One more time. And so I ask it one more time, and he says, okay, I guess if there's a God, and that God has said something about this, we'd have to factor that in. I go, well, that's what we should be talking about. That's the more fundamental question. And we were off and running. And of course, now that was very helpful because it diffused the situation, and it put it on my turf, too. Now we can talk about Christian apologetics. Is there a God, and has that God spoken? I got to tell you, I want that God involved in the conversation, because I'm not going to change anybody's mind about sexual orientation or practice, for goodness sakes. And the end of the story, In about 15 minutes, my brother had this sunken living room with a hearth in the middle of it, you know, and I'm standing on it talking to the room of people, answering their questions about this. My brother walks around the corner and just facepalms. We didn't get any converts, but I did learn an important technique. I think the Lord was teaching me well that day, that you got to bring it back on the rails, this kind of conversation, because it can be very derailing.
Thank you very much. Such helpful answer. Thank you. Let's have hands up again. I think there's a gentleman on this section here who wanted to ask a question in the blue shirt. We'll go.
Thank you for a really interesting, stimulating day. My question is, thinking about Jesus' prayer for the visible unity of his followers, and he prays that they might be completely one so that the world will know. And this has been referred to as the ultimate apologetic. Do the panel think that the divided nature of the church is a key issue in our apologetic approach to the world, and that if we're preaching a message of forgiveness and love and reconciliation, but we're not reconciled to one another, can we really expect the world to take us seriously?
Well, I imagine we've got a variety of different church denominations here up here on the platform. And in a sense, that may speak a little bit to your question anyway. But I wonder, Christy, would you mind starting us off on this one with some thoughts and how important that unity thing is and how on earth we get there if it is important?
Such a great question. Thank you for asking that. Because it's the unity, as we were saying earlier on, that unless people see that we are united, and Jesus says to us, it's with the love that you love one another that others will know your love for me. And the thing about unity is that it's something that we often think, oh, I've got to work really hard to actually establish and forge unity with others. Whereas what it seems to me that Jesus is saying is that you already are united, so live out your unity. So, of course, there are going to be different doctrinal, perhaps, perspectives and issues on particular, perhaps secondary issues. But I think the question then comes back to how do I love somebody who has a different view to me on a secondary issue, and how am I talking about them to my friends who don't yet know Jesus? So I think I'd want to, then they might have questions on that, but I think I'd start with how do I best speak about difference and diversity in the church in a way that shows we're living out our unity rather than trying to forge it and then create more division. So I think I'd kind of start in that kind of general ballpark area.
Does anyone else want to make a comment on this? I don't know if Paul, could I pick on you?
One of the things I think is the ways in which, and I think you were getting at this, is that these secondary issues become primary points of focus. And I think what we have to do is step back and we have to say to ourselves, all right, what do we have unity on? And I think it's actually much bigger than the things that we're going to fight about. But sometimes we all get cantankerous and we're looking for things to fight about. And I think that that's one of the things that's actually a temptation. I think that stirring up the pot about something that's actually not significant is where we have to stop and ask ourselves, how important is this question? Where does it really rank in terms of my notions of salvation and walking with Jesus and flourishing with him? And if it actually isn't, if it's like how we handle communion, and it, and on one level, it's like, no, we're all doing communion. We all think it's an important thing. But it's a little different in your church than mine. I think, okay, wait, we could actually do that. I can actually enjoy what's happening at your church, and you can enjoy what's happening in mine. We may have some theological differences. But overall, what we want to say is, but who is Jesus? What's the resurrection? And how do I need this in my life?
And if I may add a point as well. So every week I sit down to have discussions with people. And very often it's a non-Christian and a Christian joining me for discussion. But it's also quite often Christians of different perspectives. And they may be differing on questions of ethics or doctrine or ecclesiology or whatever it might be. And I think actually that showing that Christians can disagree agreeably is actually quite an important witness to the non-Christian listening or watching audience, because actually the way we treat each other is a marker, even if we disagree. And we all disagree in the world all the time about all kinds of things. But if we can do it in a way where we don't simply reject each other, but we can still say to someone, I love you, and we're a brother and sister in Christ, then I think that can actually, even though we may not agree totally, still be something that encourages those who are not Christians to see, maybe there's something in this. We live in such a divided society, and in the political sphere and everywhere else, where people simply dismiss each other out of hand. And if Christians can set a different example of unity within that diversity that does obviously exist, and I think that can be an amazing...
Can I just add one more piece to that? That in difference is opportunity, because it pushes you to a position to refine the ideas that you have, and you actually might realize, oh, I don't really know why I think that thing's important. And it pushes you to a place where you can actually take that as an opportunity, that somebody's actually given you a gift when they push you on the idea that you have, and you think, you know what I need to do? I need to go think more about that and understand why that is true to me.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, that was myself and some of the panel at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2019 in London. Were you there? Wasn't it great? Well, whether you were or weren't there, you can relive it with over 13 hours of video and audio from this year's conference, all of the main sessions and all of the seminars available. If you go and pre-order the DVD or digital download now at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Look for the DVD link at the top of the page. It'll take you to our Premier shop where you can order this year's conference on DVD or digital download. It's been great to feature some of the content from this year's conference. No time this week, of course, for any of your feedback. We'll make sure to do some of that because we've had lots come in over the last few weeks to some of these various shows we've been hosting in recent weeks. For now, it's time to say thank you for joining me for today's edition of the programme. And let me tell you what's coming up at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. Well, one of the stories dominating my social media over the summer months has been Josh Harris renouncing Christianity, it would appear. But before this latest announcement, he was best known as a pastor and author of the book I Kissed Dating Goodbye, very influential in the evangelical purity culture movement of the late 90s. Well, recently a documentary called I Survived I Kissed Dating Goodbye saw Josh apologising for that book and the effect it had on many people. Well, we're going to be talking to the producer of that documentary, Jessica van der Wingard, who will be joining me to talk about Josh, his journey, her own journey, as someone who read that book and was influenced by it. And Sean McDowell joins us for the conversation. His father, Josh McDowell, was a leading figure in the 80s and 90s purity culture movement. And Sean says, yes, there have been things wrong with the evangelical purity culture movement, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. They're going to be debating whether it's time to kiss goodbye to Christian purity culture on next week's show. Hope you can be with me for that. Thanks for being with me today, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.